Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 26 of What's It Like? My guest is Victor Vanacore. Hey, Victor, how you doing?
I'm fine today, Ken. Yourself?
I'm doing okay. Good. Victor Vanacore, such great alliteration. Is that your real name?
Yes, it is, actually.
I'd have to go with, like, Tommy Tangen or something. It just doesn't sound the same, but it sounds really nice as a combination for you.
Well, it also sounds nice because it's musical.
Yes. Is it Italian?
Yes, it is. It's probably if I was born in Italy, it would be Vittorio Vanacore, but we use Victor Vanacore, it suffices enough here in America.
So you grew up in the East Coast?
Yes, I'm a native of Connecticut. I was born and raised in Connecticut, in New Haven, Connecticut, actually.
Italian family in Connecticut, big family get-togethers, and speaking Italian, or entirely different?
No, it's pretty much that. We grew up with... my parents were also born here, but my grandparents were immigrants, and my grandfather was an immigrant to the New Haven area. My mother's father was an immigrant to the Brooklyn area and in New York, and my mom and dad met. I come from five brothers and a sister, and we were born and raised in New Haven. And, we had family get-togethers, always based around the Victrola, you know, always having music in the house and Italian music and plus American music.
Did you speak Italian growing up?
My folks spoke in a Neapolitan dialect, so we wouldn't know what they were talking about. And and then, of course, I had an unexpected pleasure of being stationed also in Italy during the Vietnam conflict. So I was able to learn a second language and then continue on and really learned it later on with, you know, private tutors. And then, of course, I used to go back to Europe a lot, and between Spanish and English, I have an easy time almost in any country rehearsing. So
yeah, gives you lots of choices.
It does.
As a conductor, it seems to me that the great fun is you have a whole bunch of people to play with. It's like having your own gigantic instrument.
Well, yes, but the difference between having a gigantic instrument and a gigantic orchestra, so to speak, is that you don't have the gigantic egos and personalities that go along with it. And you know, I should actually say that. I should say the gigantic talent that goes along with it when you have one instrument or 80-piece orchestra. So it's a high-flying trapeze act in a way because, you know, you don't want to offend them with anything, but you want to cajole them and encourage them. And also, you know, if you're in front of an A orchestra, you're in front of pretty accomplished musicians who have spent their lives practicing discipline almost the way a golfer goes to his discipline. So it's a balancing act. But it's lovely. I enjoy it. I have the kind of personality for it. When you know your music, nothing much more has to be said, I think. You know, I pretty much write everything that I conduct, although I do conduct other people's music. But it's fun. I enjoy it. I have a great time. I can't wait to go to work. So.
You didn't start off with orchestra, I suspect. Did you begin with piano?
Oh, yes. To begin and end with piano. The whole thing started and probably will end with piano. it always was my instrument as a classically trained when I was younger. And then I got into some nightclub playing in the early 60s in Connecticut and New York area on the Connecticut Turnpike. And I got into club dates at an early age. And
you must have been a kid.
Yeah, I was about, I think, 13 or 14 years old when I got my cabaret card.
Wow.
You had to have a cabaret card to play. And one of my steady jobs was a restaurant. So I had to be sure, one of the letters that I had from the state was I had to play in a place that served food. It just couldn't be a bar. But I also found my way into those, too, because there was only three piano players in our town. So it wasn't like the plethora of piano players or musicians or great musicians that you get here in Los Angeles, where I came from. There weren't a lot of, you know, piano players, let's say, in the 60s in my town.
So growing up, how did your parents impact your worldview?
Well, they didn't impact my worldview musically, but they certainly impacted my worldview as far as how to treat people. How humility, my father was always preaching humility. That sort of thing. Although I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder when I went into the service because I didn't want to leave home, but the military sort of knocked that off. My worldview was that, you know, treat everybody the way that you want to be treated and be proud of your heritage. And also there was always laughter and music in our house. So everything was done with a certain amount of sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So my brothers and I are very close, and my sister, and we laugh a lot when we get together. And I think it's part of how we grew up.
So a pretty musical family?
We always sang and everything around the Victrola. My dad always bought home records. I got into music sort of by mistake, in a way. I was going to, my mom had a lot of kids, and I was the more precocious one. And so an aunt of ours recommended that they sent me to Catholic school, but I was only about 5 or 6. So I went away to Catholic kindergarten, and I'd have to wait for my father to pick me up at the convent at 5 o'clock when he got out of work. So I had about 2 hours to kill, and the music teacher there took an interest in me and started teaching me piano. And so I had, you know, lessons from kindergarten or first grade all the way through. I mean, all the way through. So it was kind of a mistake. I mean, my dad didn't hear me play the piano until I was about 3 or 4 years into it. You know, this teacher, she was a lover of music and was an incredibly accomplished musician herself. I mean, it was like almost a miracle because I don't, you know. But anyway, that's how I started out. And then, of course, when he saw that I played, he started bringing me home. He started hanging out at the music store in town, which was run by a gentleman named Sal Libro, who just got out of the big bands during the World War II. You know, so in the 50s, he opened up his own music store. And so my father started hanging around there, and that's when he bought me home my first fake book for me to learn tunes.
Ah, music came easily for you. Did the rest of school?
Not mathematics, unfortunately. And I think, again, I was, you know, the oldest of a bunch of kids, and we were. I wasn't the greatest student in school, although my IQ was high. I don't think I had any teachers that understood me. Whereas, for instance, when I was student teaching back in the 70s, I always understood the ones that used to get in trouble the most because I was like that. So
yes,
I always understood the ones that stood out. But it was okay. I did a concert recently in Connecticut of Spanish music, and my Spanish teacher from the 7th grade showed up, and I asked her what I was like. You know, I asked her, so what was it like? And, you know, she kind of was pretty honest, and she told me, she said, but, you know, it was that she understood me. So it's kind of great to sort of look back on your life and see what made what you are today, that kind of a thing. So to answer your question, I wasn't a great student, but in music in high school and Spanish and biology and science and history, I was very good. It was mathematics that I was terrible in, and I just couldn't, you know. I don't think the teachers understood me, but, you know, before that, when you're in high school, you know, if the teacher doesn't like the student, then the student winds up not liking the teacher. Then all of a sudden, you get this mental block about mathematics or algebra, and it just proliferates, as you go through school. It doesn't get any easier because you don't understand that concept. Like my son told me one day, gee, Dad, you know, thanks for helping me out with that, because when it clicked big time. Well, certain subjects never really clicked for me. I mean, I can make them click for somebody else because I understand, you know, what has to be woken up. But for me, it was not that. It was never that way.
Was there an event in your childhood that you think defines you most in terms of what you have become as an adult?
Yes, there were two events. You know, when they happen when you're a child, the events don't wind up making that impact. In other words, the hammer hits, but you don't feel the impact until your mind is mature enough emotionally to understand what happened to you. Mm-hmm. So there were two events that happened to me, and I understood that from those two events, certainly being forced to go to a convent and having to be put with all the older kids, getting through kindergarten and the first grade and music lessons, that was a big thing. But there were two really, really watershed events in my life that propelled me into understanding what I was, you know, that I was supposed to do something with my life. So
mm-hmm.
One was I got in trouble on a family picnic at a place in Connecticut called Fort Hale Park, and it's a very, very large cliff. And anyway, to make a long story short, I got stuck on this cliff, and they finally pulled me off. But I got stuck on my belt, which hung up on this cliff, and my mother had been forcing me that morning to wear a belt, and I never liked to wear belts. I always liked the jeans without belts, and that's what wound up getting stuck and keeping me from falling off the cliff. When they rescued me, they had to pull me off the stump that my belt was hung up on. And the second one, again, was another cliff incident, oddly enough, in the Mediterranean when I was in the Navy. I decided to go swimming in January. I just got there and to the orchestra that I was going to be assigned with, and We decided to go swimming. I never checked the water temperature. But anyway, to make a long story short, I wound up in the water. I got swept out by an undercurrent. And they found me on a rock way away from where I was. Anyway, I had to be rescued again. So at around 20, when I got back stateside and I started college, I was reflecting. And I started to look back and I started to think, gee, you know, how many more signs do I need to see? You know, I always took music seriously, but then I started to take life seriously. And that's really what changed me, I think, when I looked back and I realized what had happened. It made me take everything so much, you know, you don't realize, I heard a basketball player say the other night that got injured and now he's back playing again. You know, you don't realize what you have until you almost lose it. And, you know, so I look forward to every day practicing. It's for me, music is a very spiritual thing also. However, I am spiritual with my religion, but also music also provides that food for my soul. To me, a day without practicing almost is a day without any food. So
do you have a favorite piano?
No, not really. I don't have a favorite piano because I've played some great Steinways. I've played some great Kawais. Mm-hmm. I played some great Bösendorfers and Fazioli's. So I think whatever one responds, I love to play very expressive, and I love like the way Glenn Gould played, Keith Jarrett, Oscar Peterson. So I'm really into how I can make that piano sound expressive, being a percussive instrument that it is. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't have a favorite instrument because to me they all react differently. I mean, you could find two Steinways that'll play totally different from each other.
When you are doing your arranging, do you use a regular piano or do you go electronic?
When I'm arranging, sometimes I'll take a break from practicing and I'll start writing at the piano and keep it in my head. But I have a pretty nice weight-sensitive keyboard that's hooked up to my rig, and I usually write from that or sketch from that anyway. And then sometimes I'll come up with an idea away from the instrument, like totally might be a totally different idea away from the instrument that I'll be singing in my head, and then I'll develop that when I get back to the instrument, or maybe not. Maybe I'll just develop it in my hotel room. But normally, I'll write it either keyboard. And as far as orchestrating or arranging it, I play the parts in. So any music students that are listening, I stopped using scores. I just use a sketch. I pretty much, instead of laying it out on score paper, the sequence page in my software is my score paper.
Ah.
So I've eliminated that amount of thinking.
Mm-hmm. So you use MIDI to put the general ideas in?
Yeah, I play the parts in MIDI as if I'm looking at a page full of instruments, starting with the flutes at the top and the strings at the bottom. I already have an idea what I want to do. So I just go off my sketch to figure out what measure number I'm at.
To become a composer, arranger, musical director, how do you actually do that?
Well, first of all, in today's atmosphere, it's not as easy to get started. I mean, when I came out here in the 70s, there was a certain lot of opportunities. I did a lot of television. I was being a recording musician. But there was always that allure of, you know, wanting to be in front of an orchestra, wanting to conduct. So when I got my first few offers, I took them instead of staying in town. So it was easy for me back then. But like today, it's how does one do that? Well, let's see. I was a pianist to begin with. And when I went to the Berklee College of Music, I studied with a marvelous conducting teacher. And so I was with him, I think, 6 or 7 semesters. And he was Lithuanian. And I always had, For some strange reason, I always attracted European teachers. Like my piano teacher was a European when I was younger. Both of them were from Europe. And this Lithuanian, Geronimus Kaczynskas was his name. Jerry Kaczynskas was a marvelous conductor. And he saw that I had some ability with a stick. So we went extra. We took master classes together with him. And then, of course, I had all the arranging courses at Berklee, all the jazz arranging, which I really, really dug into. I loved all their arranging there. So when I got out to California, all I had to do was eventually find an orchestration teacher to teach me how to orchestrate and about all the different instruments and colors of the orchestra. And then I started putting it together around 1980. And then in 1990, I really started, I knew that that's where I wanted to spend the rest of my life, was doing symphony pops concerts, but a little bit more on the bleeding edge side of it, so to speak. I wanted to push, in other words, if I was going to write symphony pop charts, I wanted them to be good. I wanted them to be playable by the players, but enjoyable by the audience. And so they always have a bit of over-the-topness mm-hmm. to them. And a bit of not your standard symphony pop fare, so to speak.
They have a nice fullness to them.
They have a fullness to them. It's been described as cinematic type approach to symphony pop's arrangements. Like if I do an arrangement, like I did one for the Berklee College of Music that I use in one of my concert shows, and it's called Spain Meets Birdland, and it's Spain and Birdland juxtaposed over each other. And you know, when you write arrangements of those tunes, you have to use, you know, what's available as far as your knowledge. You can't, you know, I always want the orchestra to sound a little bit more like people that I've listened to, like Gerald Wilson or Don Ellis, as opposed to sounding on the other side of things, the playing side. And I don't want to mention any names, but so that's always been my approach to it. So I always want the players to. I read something the other night where, you know, how they hate to play eggs, which are the whole notes, and you know how, and so I'm typically on the other side of that. I always like to write challenging parts and to keep them musical for the player. And every time I do a concert, it's a wonderful thing because the people say, "Gee, I love the music. I love what you did with that arrangement." And the orchestra seem to like it too, and they like it because they're not playing anything that's gratuitous. That's there just to keep them busy. I always try to include something that's musical for them to play, and inevitably, it adds to the arrangement. So
yeah, what's the best thing about your job?
What's the best thing? Let's see. I think the enjoyment that it brings people, and then of course the ancillary benefit that you get from it is that it makes the people feel good, and then also they'll. Like I just came back from Florida with the Florida Symphony, and when they came up to me, I said, "Well, I'll be back in December for a Christmas concert. Oh, we're going to go to that. We love the music, and it encourages them to come back to see more symphony pop shows, and eventually they'll see classical shows. And I feel that I'm contributing to our American orchestra, which we have in every city, but I don't think that a lot of the populace don't relate to it. I think like I have arrangements of Earth, Wind, and Fire. I have arrangements of Gloria Estefan, but I also have arrangements of Emil Waldefell. I have a thing of Chopin. So it runs the gamut. So, but when I do play the hot charts, like Spain and Birdland and Motown and some of the swing numbers I have in my show, it empowers the orchestra to play them, but also empowers the people to say, "Wow, we're going to come back. We like this." So I feel like I'm sort of helping the symphony pops industry and putting on some great shows and making the people aware that, wow, a symphony orchestra doesn't have to, it can sound contemporary, it can sound popish, so to speak, or jazz, playing a jazz idiom. And that's what I feel like I'm doing, I'm accomplishing.
You've worked with a lot of big names in the music business. What's that been like?
It's been a learning experience. It's been, I learned from Johnny Mathis how to accompany a great singer. I learned from Barry Manilow how to put on a great show. You know, I learned from Ray Charles how to play slow, how to conduct slow. Actually, I always played slow, but I never really liked to conduct slow. Nobody likes to conduct slow or play slow. And Ray was a definite, you know, and I loved it. I mean, now I have to watch out I don't play too slow when I play a ballad. So I've actually gotten some great experience working with the singers that I work with in my career. I have... I've learned, you know, just a lot of things, how to put on how to be efficient with rehearsal and get it done, get the performance done without killing anybody, without repeating myself, without being boring, you know, that whole thing. So
what surprised you the most about your job?
Surprises me the most? How much I'm still learning.
Mm-hmm.
That surprises me the most. I don't think anything else can surprise me too much. but I think that's what surprises me. The fact that I'll hear something and I'll go and I'll think, wow, I got to find out what color that was. Or I have to, and then I'll learn it. And then I'll go, wow, I'm glad I have that in my arsenal. Or I'll listen to somebody play the piano and I'll say, gee, I'm going to listen to that again and see what that person did on the piano. So that's what's surprising me. I had a teacher one time told me to never stop learning because when you see all these people that are, you know, with the prevalence of Alzheimer's and dementia and everything, I always think that the brain is a muscle and it has to be used. I have an 86-year-old mom who refuses to look up a phone number because she figures that if she looks up a phone number, she's taking the easy way out. If she tries to remember it or forget or or not concentrate so much on it, it'll come to her, mm-hmm. that she's using that muscle that people seem to be losing. So I think there's some validity to that. So I always want to challenge myself to look at a score or transpose everything back to concert, see what this one particular, whether it's Stravinsky, Prokofiev, whoever, Debussy, what did they do to get that sound? That I'm using that brain, also I'm appreciating that art. So,
I think fame is sort of a level thing. You can be famous in the fifth grade by having red hair or something else. What level of fame are you at?
Well, I don't know. No level. I mean, I never thought about that. I don't. Well, I mean, if I call up certain people in the industry, like I just got off the phone with an opera singer, his secretary answered the phone, and I called and I said, I thought it was an exchange, but she was a secretary. So I said, I'd like to leave a message. And when she heard who I was, she said, you want to speak to him? And I said, well, sure. Never, you know, only thought about when I get off the phone. Gee, I guess he must have known who I was. But I never assumed that. I mean, in the business, there's, you know, other arrangers who know who I am, pianists who know who I am. But I don't think anybody thinks of it in terms of fame. I think you want to use the word respect, I think, probably. I think it's more, I think we're in it for the art's sake of it, so we don't look at it. Quincy Jones is certainly famous, but I don't think he even looks at it that way. One time somebody asked me, when I got a Grammy for Over the Rainbow arrangement I wrote, somebody asked me, what were you thinking about when you were, like, as you were writing the arrangement, like, what came into your mind? Like, what? And first of all, it's a very, very cerebral thing when you write an arrangement. I mean, it's mechanical. There's nothing emotional in it at all, but I said, I was really concerned with the spacing between the first and second trombone. and a composer at this party turned around and said, spoken like a true musician, you know, because we're so cerebral about it. You know, we're thinking about some technical thing about crossed voices or making sure that something is in the proper tessitura of an instrument. And I mean, I've written plenty of poems or tone poems where I think of the ocean and I might write a piece that sounds like the ocean, but it's very, very technical in as far as, you know, your style of, I mean, it never comes to inspiration. It always comes to perspiration, I think.
Do people ever stop you on the street?
Oh, no, no, never. Yeah. When I was younger, they said, you know, they'd stop me because I looked like somebody, but that was it. Never, never. And you know what? I'm kind of glad about it because I don't pity anybody who's famous. I certainly been around them when I was, you know, maybe doing some concerts with Johnny Mathis. You know, he couldn't go anywhere. Barry couldn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Ray was blind, so Ray didn't care. You know, he didn't care who was staring at him. So he was actually the easiest one to be around, you know. But certainly, we're musicians. I think that we enjoy a certain amount of anonymity, and it's a nice thing. It's a wonderful thing.
You know? The value of being a craftsman.
Yeah, that's really what I'm just happy. Oh, I'm thrilled with being a craftsman. I love it. I mean, mm-hmm. as long as I can play some golf and you know, help people out, do some things, you know, I'm a happy camper.
I have some more questions for Victor, but let me take a moment to introduce you to a disorder that impacts a lot of people. In the UK, it's called ME, myalgic encephalopathy. In the US, it's called CFIDS, chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome. Whatever you call it, it's a chronic neurological disease of unknown cause and no known cure. Most every body system is impacted, including the muscular, immune, and central nervous systems. Symptoms include problems with vision, balance, coordination, pain, sensitivity to cold, sound, and visual stimulus. It screws up mitochondrial production and cellular metabolism and replication. And for many, it's a totally disabling condition. And even for those patients who get better, it's a relapsing, remitting disease. Although it can occur at any age, it is most commonly found in women in their 20s and 30s. My daughter's been sick with this condition since her junior year in college. This is a disorder that really needs more research. So go to cfids.org and click on the donate button. CFIDS, CFIDS.org. Thanks. So, Victor, everyone has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
That's a good question. How do I get motivated? Well, let's see. Sometimes when I'm away from it, I can't wait to get back to it. So sometimes just a separation, like if I go away with my wife, if we take a trip or something like that, I'm certainly away from it. Also, when I go out and do concerts, like Sunday comes and if I have a matinee, I can't wait to get home to get in front of my instrument the next day or start writing.
Mm-hmm.
I guess like that, or sometimes I may be like I'll go to a concert. I just saw Herbie Hancock recently, and it was very inspiring. Or I'll go see somebody at Disney Hall, and I'll go, wow, I'll go home and I'll work on something totally different that's not even something that I do, maybe a style or something like that. So there's different, or I might hear, I used to love to listen to Fritz Kreisler on the radio, stuff like that, just putting on something, and I always get motivated by what I hear. So mm-hmm. It's very easy, actually, to get motivated.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Oh, now you ask the number one question. Golf, but it's not very soothing. I have to learn, actually. I'm going to learn how to relax on the golf course, and really, it does take my mind off of what I'm working on, though, so that when I come back, I can look at it very objectively. When I'm on the golf course, I have such a great time, but again, it's hard not to take it seriously. So I have to learn not to do that. I think once I master that, then I can really relax out there. So.
So what is your handicap?
Oh, we won't discuss that. But it's a true handicap when I tell you. It's the definition. If you look up the word handicap in the dictionary, my handicap is there.
I have a friend who says, it's my swing.
Yeah, my swing. When I put the golf clubs in my truck of my car, that's my handicap.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yes. I had to write a piece of music, which hopefully one day will be recorded, on the text of John Paul II. And the text that I was given was in Italian. At first, when I first started it, the first couple of days, I didn't think that I could do it because my thematic writing, my motifs didn't seem long enough, didn't seem like they were developed enough, and I couldn't get to the second subject. I couldn't even finish the first subject. But the more I worked with it, the better I got, and then all of a sudden it started coming out. So it kind of stretched me as a composer to write, and it's classical. It was sort of neoclassical pieces that I wrote. So that challenged me, I think, basically because I had to rely on orchestration to carry it, and so it was a lot of composing and orchestrating at the same time. And I think that was probably one of the most challenging things. I mean, just being a musician in a way is, and doing what I do is challenging as it is. I mean, there's always something new that I'm learning or something new that I'm conducting. And so when you're challenged right to the core, then anything else, I can do this, or I can handle this. So.
Your profession has changed a lot recently.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they used to call piano players or drummers or saxophone players or whatever for, sessions and things of that sort, or even live music, the Pantages or the Mark Taper. Now everybody wants to use computers and samples and things of that sort, and it takes the music out of music. It takes the music out of music, so it's not as powerful, it's not as it's not as emotional. I mean, but I call it the dumbing of America, the dumbing down of America. You keep doing it, and eventually, well, look what's on television on the major channels and some of the cables network. Some of these television shows are beyond ridiculous. So if you keep that up, that becomes the norm. And if you're not educating people, they're getting dumbed down, and they won't know after a while that West Side Story is supposed to have an orchestra in the pit. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound right without an orchestra. So it certainly has changed, Sometimes I'll watch a TV show, and I'll hear one sound just droning on forever when, years ago they would have a wonderful, musical background, which only enhances the drama. But if you keep on doing it long enough, nobody's going to miss it because the population will get older and they'll go, I like that show. And they never like it for the music. Music only helps, music is there to help it. Actually, if you see some of these shows without the music, they're pretty pathetic.
Now, you've done some TV work, haven't you?
Yeah, my brother is a very big TV composer, and he's got a lot of shows. So I work on some of them sometimes, like Survivor or Celebrity Apprentice or Apprentice or... Yeah, so I do a lot of it. Not a steady diet of it, but I do enough to keep me learning the gear, so to speak. I still have to maintain my software for writing and composing. Yeah, so I still do a lot of it, yeah.
Well, Survivor has some interesting instrumentation and interesting rhythms.
Yeah, it does. My brother David, years ago, started that whole thing with the live drums, and he would go around the world making libraries out of vocal sounds from all the different countries. So he was the one that actually got me into the computer. I don't think I ever would have gone that direction hadn't he sort of force me and say, no, this is the new thing. This is in the 90s. This is going to be, you know, you have to do music with it. You know, it's only going to get better. And I'm glad I did, because some of the music software programs like Sibelius and the like, they're fantastic. They're wonderful. I'm glad. So,
if you're giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would be your best advice? What would you say?
What would be my mantra to the kids? Let's see. Never look back and say I should have, would have, or could have, but to look forward and say I will, I shall, I can. That's just a sum up of my life's experience. You know, I used to say, gee, I should have done, I could have, or I would have. And then I started to think about it and say, well, I can, I will, I shall. So, and, you know, to love what you do. I think that's the other thing. I mean, I do a lot of challenging things, and yeah, sometimes I get a little bit nervous before a concert, only because I have so much to think about. I have to talk, I have to sit down and play the piano, and also to maintain a relaxed persona on stage so that when I sit down at the piano, it's not like my golf swing where I rush it. So, but when you love what you do, it's a nice way to grow old doing that. I mean, I never thought about what I was going to do. I always knew from the time I was in junior high school, and I got my first $15 for playing the piano at somewhere, that I thought, wow, that was quick. It's my, you know, minimum wage when I was 16 was $1.65. So I would go out on a Friday night and I'd be in a steakhouse and I'd get $15 for dinner. And I walk home and think, well, my father would say to me, look, you know, people have minimum wage. You know how long that takes. I think I worked at a Stop and Shop, which is a food mart back east. And I think I worked there for like a week and I just couldn't take it. So when I saw the value of it, of course, this was back then. I think, again, you know, I don't think you could get paid sometimes to play in a restaurant in here in Los Angeles. I'm talking about just a regular gig, not, of course, the jazz rooms. But I'm glad I grew up when I grew up, because there was a lot of demand for live music, and I was able to take my problems back to my teacher and say, look, I didn't know this on Friday night when I played with so and so, or I'd go to my classical teacher and I'd say, look, you know, I have to play this for this opera singer that's coming in. I don't understand this. And so so it was like on the job training, you know, and with a musician, ear training is probably the single most important thing that you can ever. So I was getting ear training at 13 years old, cause I had these older guys yelling out tunes in nightclubs that I didn't even know what the tunes sounded like. It was like ear training by fire. So it was great. It was a great way to grow up.
Well, my last question is to help me get better at this process. Think of a story that you haven't told me. So this can be about your life, about people you know, about any kind of story. What should I have asked you to get you to tell me that story?
Let's see. Let me think here real quick. I think the way I met Ray Charles is probably a great story, because it was so, you know, you can't make something like that up. In the late 1980s, I was at home relaxing, and I got a call on a Sunday to go to NBC, and a friend of mine, a choreographer, asked me to go down to NBC to help this arranger out. They were putting a tribute together for a president of NBC or something at the time. So I went down, and the arranger's name was Ray Charles, who's still alive today, and he used to call himself the deaf one, because there were two Ray Charles. It was him and the real Ray Charles. And so I wanted to meet him, so at the end of the session, I asked him for his address and his phone number, and he gave it to me. And I was sending him a resume out, I think, the next day, or a note thanking him, because he was a lovely person to work with. And I lost the thing. So I looked in the musician's directory, and I'll think, okay, there's only going to be maybe one or two Ray Charles's in here, and I don't think the singer, the famous Ray Charles, is not going to have his name in the book, in this musician's directory. So I looked at it, and I see this office on West Washington Boulevard. I think that's got to be the Ray Charles I met yesterday. So I sent him this letter. So the real Ray Charles gets the letter while his manager gets it on the same day his conductor of 40 years retires.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so I got called by this office and said, come down and talk to this Ray Charles's manager. However, I'm thinking it's the guy that I met yesterday. So I get off the freeway at Western Avenue, and I pull into this parking lot, and I think, well, this is kind of a weird place for a guy in Beverly Hills to have an office. But I thought, you know, why not? So I park the car, and I go upstairs, and they said, Mr. So-and-so will be out to see you in a minute. So I said, okay, fine. He said, would you like some coffee? And I said, sure. We went into the kitchen, and there's a big picture of Ray Charles on the wall. And so I thought, gee, I'm at the right place. At first I thought, gee, I'm at the wrong place. But then the music that I was given to conduct an orchestra on Friday night in Atlanta, didn't tell me very much about how to rehearse the orchestra, because it was kind of like, it was very, very sparse music. I mean, it was not, it, there wasn't any cues on it. They weren't scores. They were like just little melody lines with, it was like a road, what we call with music, a road map. So I called a friend of mine and I said, you know, who can help me out with these songs? Who might know these songs? I don't know all of them. And they said, well, here's the number. This guy's Ray Charles. He lives in Beverly Hills. Call him. So I call him, and he remembered me from, you know, yesterday. So I go over to his house, and when I showed him the book of sketches that I had of road maps, he goes, gee, these look like Ray Charles songs. And I said, well, they are. And he said, are you going to conduct for him? I said, yeah, Friday night. He said, well, what happened to Sid Feller? I said, well, he retired after 40 years. And I said, well, how did you get the job? I said, I tried to call you, but I called the wrong place. So that's my story.
What a fun way to meet.
Yeah, well, everything wonderful that's happened in music to me has happened through a story. It's happened like, you know, I would get these jobs or referrals, actually jobs, by calling people. Or, you know, that's how I met Johnny Mathis. That's how I met Barry Manilow. It was never through a recommendation. It was always through something, some sort of bravado or, mm-hmm. you know, getting steered in the right way by my emotions or something.
It's back to your idea of doing rather than just waiting.
Yeah, the other thing, too, that I would tell a commencement class would be to sort of be the master of your own destiny. In other words, you are responsible for your present. Like a graduate is responsible for being in that chair that day on graduation. They got themselves there. They were responsible for putting themselves in that seat at graduation. The same they're going to be responsible for being in a seat on a job. I mean, so you've got to give yourself your own kick of the pants. Find out what it is that makes you tick and go ahead and be the master of your destiny. If you're, you know, in debt behind the eight balls because you put yourself there, even mm-hmm. if somebody else did it, you're still the master of your own destiny. You have to be. And when a problem confronts you, you know, you can't run from it because it's going to, you know, it's especially if it's got to do with your life. You've got to tackle it head on and man up or woman up to it and just do it.
I want to thank Victor Vanacore for joining me today. Thanks, Victor. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Doctor. Thank you.